Hello, everyone, and welcome to Hashtag No Limits. I am your host, Shelley Kino. Hashtag No Limits is about people who society has placed limits upon, but who are busting through those limits. That can't be an easy task. I believe that we know who we are, but not who we will be. And Ophelia says that in Hamlet. I believe that there is no better or more beautiful example than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. For those who don't know, the caterpillar literally has to dissolve into its cells and then reform into the butterfly. It's still not finished struggling, though. It has to struggle while it's in the cocoon in order for its wings to be strong enough to fly once it gets out. As I said, none of that can be easy, but neither is busting through the limits that society places upon people. And today I'm excited to share with you my guest, Kevin O'Connor. He is someone who has been there from the beginning of co-teaching, inclusion, and he's going to share with us some of the strategies, some of the techniques, and then also how that has played such an important role in bringing him to where he is today. So, Kevin, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great here. Thanks for having me. I appreciated our pre-call a couple of weeks ago and getting acquainted more with other podcasts that you have and the interesting guests that you have. I will go on and give a rating to you. I haven't done that yet, but I promise to do that.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Yeah, I really have enjoyed all of my guests. You are episode number 174, so there have been 173 before you. And
wow.
I am just so touched and overwhelmed almost every week by the great things that are happening in individuals' lives. And then I also have some, you know, companies that have come on and shared the innovations that they have. And so that's kind of what we're doing today is, I mean, you're not a company, but you are going to talk about co-teaching. And that is something that I still think, even after all the years that it's been around, still isn't done enough. And mm-hmm. when it's done, many times it's not done correctly.
Right.
So give us a little bit of your background and kind of, like I said at the intro, what brought you to us today?
Okay. Background, I've been involved in education and teaching since 1973. That wasn't my undergrad major, but I decided that that's what I wanted to pursue was a teaching degree in that part of educational history in California, where I got my teaching credential. There was no undergraduate degree in education. Everybody had to get a degree of their choosing and then go into what was called their credential year. I'm not sure they still do that. So they call it the credential year or the fifth year. Oftentimes that fifth year could lead into master's degrees and things too, for higher degrees, but you had to do that in order to get certified as a teacher. And it was the program I was in as I look back professionally, historically, is what led me into collaborative teaching and to co-teaching and the things I did as a principal. Because in my year intern teaching that year, 1973-74, I was in multi-age settings. And that certainly was a different kind. Although I'd been in my own education as an elementary kid, I'd been into split classrooms where the teacher would go to the fourth grade side and then the fifth grade side or whatever. I hadn't been in a classroom where all the grades were contained in one classroom with the teacher responsible for individualizing. So my first job assignment was a K-1-2-3 classroom, right out of student teaching. And I think I was just sort of thrust in that environment to recognize that every learner is different and there's nothing that you can attach a grade level to. And right away, it got me out of the concept of thinking along grade level terms or that we all learn in grade level segments. And so that those first couple of years, got me more into Piaget and developmental psychology and how all that plays into education. And that's how I did my master's paper on at Berkeley. And then as I got more involved into, then I got into just grade level teaching as I moved back to the Midwest where I was from. And I was always had this thing about, we don't learn in grade levels. We learn in more diverse types environments. And even in a single grade setting where I was for the most part, although we did some multi-age classrooms too, in the settings, it seemed like when I started as a principal at this particular district in 1989, they were just starting into a program of the concept of co-teaching. And for me, that was just a great model that built on what I'd learned the prior 15 years about developmental teaching, Piaget, the way we all learn at different times, the way that we need support with different things. So that's what got me into this, and how I got directed to you, that was part of your question. I think it was through one of the podcast match programs, and I get drawn to the ones that focus on education. I retired from education, full-time education 4 years ago, and I've been doing other things, writing books and doing other things. But I got a strong pull to education. So when I saw your prompt there and started investigating and getting to know you better, I knew I wanted to participate in some way. So that's how I got to you.
Awesome. So you mentioned your book, and I have it here. There we go. Okay. So I'm going to screen share your book. So let's talk about that really quickly, because it's not really related to what we're really going to dive deep into today, but it is what brought you to me and it is important. So I want you to share about your book and how people can get your book. They should be able to get it through one of the threads right?
Any one of those. And this is my website, KevinO'ConnorAuthor.com. That's what you have the picture of. And the book was written. I was raised in a funeral home, a unique experience. And a part of what I talk about in the book, too, is a little bit why didn't I go into the funeral home business, and how the educational field is not unlike the service industry of which the funeral home industry is a part of. And so a lot of what I learned as a youth in growing up in a funeral home, I applied to education. The idea that people are different. People approach grief in different ways. People approach education in different ways. Each teacher has their own teaching style. Each student has their own learning style. And just the physicality of education. This is the things I did as a kid in a funeral home, greeting people at the door, getting ready for programs, taking down and setting up chairs, watching my dad plan a funeral the same way I would plan a curriculum or plan a lesson. So there's just a lot of tie-ins. Although, like you said, I don't get a whole lot into the correlations in the book. The book focuses more on those years from 1950 to 1975, from birth till I was 25, and my experiences as a funeral home kid. And I invite your listeners to take a look at it and see what take an interest in it. But part of me thinks that, and who knows, you can never go back and say, gee, if I hadn't been a funeral kid, a home kid, I wouldn't be a teacher. No, I can't say that, but right. I can say there are certain things that they dovetail together. My growing up experiences led me to being a teacher with a career of 50 years. So thanks for giving me the opportunity to mention the book, but also for giving me the opportunity to go to my roots, which is education. My professional roots are in education. So. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those who are not watching this on a video, but you are only listening to it, it is Kevin O'Connor, and that's K-E-V-I-N, and then O'Connor, O-C-O-N-N-O-R, author. So KevinO'ConnorAuthor.com. And then what you're not seeing, if you're not watching, if you're just listening to it, down at the bottom are his Instagram handles, his LinkedIn handles, Goodreads, and lots of other things. So I recommend, if you are just listening to this, that you go back to the show notes, and hopefully you will find a link to the YouTube version so that you can get all the extra information as to where you can sign up for his newsletter, finding him on Facebook, Instagram, and all the other places that I mentioned before. So
thank you, Shelly, for all those connections. You have a way to intertwine, and those like yourself, going back into education years, we didn't have this kind of stuff. And to see how you've magically intertwined all these links is wonderful. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I can't really take the credit for it, because it is the platform StreamYard that I am using. And I highly recommend anyone, whether you are having a meeting with just a few people, or, you know, you're doing a webcast, a webinar, a podcast, whatever, StreamYard is absolutely amazing. And I have used it since I started, and I absolutely love it. And they're always improving it and always adding new features and new things. So it's definitely one. And I'm not getting paid to say all of these things. It's just truly how I feel about them. So
yeah.
I would be happy if they wanted to sponsor this particular podcast. Mm-hmm, but that's another time and another day. So let's go back to what we were joining together today to talk about. So when you talk about co-teaching, well, first, let's go back even a little bit further. So inclusion in 1975, and I always get it mixed up if it's 73 or 75, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, as we know it now, it was originally public law 94-142, education for all handicapped children. And that was the special education law that said we now need to educate all of our students, not just the ones that fit a certain mold. And so that started right around the time that you were finishing up your undergrad degree and then going into that year, credential year.
Right.
And so how did that evolve in your life as far as how you taught and who you taught?
Okay. Super question. Pleasantly, I'm able to go back to those first years, 73, 74, 75, as that law was starting to be known or come out and hadn't really been applied yet. But thinking, happened to be with a wonderful principal at that building for the first couple of years, and then a district that wanted to keep looking. This is in Vallejo, California, and wanted to keep looking at ways to provide for kids. And that's partly where I think the school was all multi-age. So every classroom had a multi-age setting. And I look back on my career and just so appreciative of being put into that position at that time in the 70s, to see and to witness and to participate and to be a fixture, more than a fixture, but be a player in how to make it all work, and the teams and the support. I mean, when I look at it as from a special ed point of view, though, I'm looking back at that. That was before the time that teachers were even funded to be special ed educators. We had resource people, and we had, I was assigned the way that building was done, which is the first sign I had of co-teaching or that kind of model, even back in 73, was we had 21 teachers on the staff, and each of seven of us were assigned to one resource teacher who had another assistant that she worked with, and they would work with us to create our lessons and to come into our classrooms and to work collaboratively. So I never in my teaching career, especially at the beginning, I never had that experience of a teacher being put into a classroom all by themselves. And I think it's probably still apparent in some districts, but that idea from the very start of my career, I always had a collaborator. I always had Also, the school provided me with a full-time aide.
That's amazing.
Yeah. At that point, they were using Title I funds. So some of the funding for that was from the early times of Title I and ways to provide the monies to have, although we had big classrooms, I had 32 kids in my class, but I had a full-time aide who I could work with and have two people in the room all the time. So that was rarely in my teaching career was I ever completely alone in a classroom where I was on my own. And I think, when I go back historically and professionally into the 70s, and you're referencing the law, I think I was experiencing that, but probably didn't know it at the time. You know, right. As some of my salary was paid by Title I funds. And I think probably if we go back, it's Title I that is sort of the root of that law and how it all started being put into the school systems. And each school system could take it or leave it. And I happened to be in a district that was taking it. I'm not sure they had the choice, come to think of it, but each and the plans we put together and the reporting we had to do and the accountability we had to do was just so essential to the framework that built my career and led me into later decisions and later things I did in my career. So yeah, that was an exciting time and things that teachers prior to, when I think about my own education, mostly in a parochial school in the 50s and 60s, and I don't think it was just because I was a parochial school setting. I think it was probably similar in the public school settings. There just weren't those resources that we had starting in the mid 70s and beyond, and the availability of those resources. So things in the last 50 years and certainly we have ways to go, but in the last 50 years, it's certainly has benefited students that probably weren't benefited in the 50s and 60s. And when I think back in my own experiences as a kid, I think of some of the kids in my class and not to put labels on them, but sure. As I look back at those experiences, we're all thrust into the same classroom. And other than having a reading group here or there, everybody was expected to do the same thing at the same time and meet the same expectations. Mm-hmm. That can't be done. There was no such thing as the word individual. So,
right. And in those early stages, like you mentioned with your education, you had your undergrad degree in something else. And then your fifth year, you went and did your credentialing. Mm-hmm. When that law was put into place, there had been no training for any teacher about working with kids with special needs.
No.
And so, I mean, I've heard stories, and I don't know if these are true. I've never actually been able to go back and verify this, but it was basically, well, do you want to teach this population? Okay, then you can go teach this population. And they were pulling cafeteria workers that said, yeah, I'll do it. And they were pulling, you know, anybody. And there was just nothing, you know, how to have high expectations, how to teach them, how to reach them, how to look at the brain in a different way. And so, yes, we have come a long way. But as you said, we still can continue to progress because we are constantly getting more and more information about how the brain develops and the fact that it doesn't develop the same for every kid, no matter how old they are. Mm-hmm. And that I loved what you said at the beginning, that putting a grade to somebody and saying, well, you're this age and you go to this grade. There are other countries in the world that don't do that. And I think they're much more successful in educating their students.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in many ways we're still tied to that grade level orientation. And this, even with everything we know about the brain.
Right.
It becomes, I always feel like it's an organizational tool. It's just an easy way for schools to categorize kids. You just pick a beginning and an ending birth date in a given 12-month period and say, this is grade whatever. And it's still, part of your theme of the program, I think, is No Limits, breaking down barriers. Well, we still have this barrier in education that we have to keep breaking down. And whether it's right. with a principal or a superintendent or a parent or the kids themselves or our communities, to still keep that message going that say, hey, just because your kid, your child, I don't know why I use a better word than kid, just because your child is fifth grade doesn't mean that they don't have capabilities or things they're doing that are more at a, if for using labels, at a seventh grade level, or at a, and the same student might be operating at a third grade level, and some of, and just to tie that in, it's him, I still, even right. I speaking now are thinking, I'm still talking about grade level parameters when I know darn well that's not how the brain or the body works. I think it's, we all have to continue to be steadfast in just keeping this dialogue going, and taking it a step further. When you get into co-teaching, every teacher is developmentally different. Every teacher is not into a, just because they're 30 years of teaching doesn't mean that they can't listen to somebody that's got 5 years of teaching or whatever. I mean, and that the whole idea, I use a term a lot, probably in your vocabulary too, the whole idea of intersectionality. We talk about intersectionality in regards to neurodivergences and what a student brings to a table for just a picture of a table or a learning lesson. But there's lots of intersectionality with teachers too. And certainly I learned that as a principal. How to create, lead, manage a team of teachers that were at many different places and had many different strengths. So, and boy, I could talk for a long time. I'll turn it back to you. Where you want to go with this?
Well, and it's very interesting, I think, because we talk so much in the world of education about, you know, things are supposed to be scientifically proven and research-based as far as curriculums go, but then we don't actually follow that thought process when we look at how kids learn. You know, we want to do that for the curriculum, but not the actual person receiving that curriculum, which that doesn't make any sense to me, that we just continue to ignore, I feel, the science that we have found, like I said, about how the brain develops. And, you know, I remember, 20 years ago, functional MRIs were, I think it was 20 years ago, it might have been, we'll say that. I don't know if it was less or more, but, you know, that they had the ability with these fMRIs to see what parts of the brain were activating during different types of learning.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet here we are all these years later, and we're still not utilizing that information. We still don't have those even performed on learners to know, like, okay, this is more of a kinesthetic learner, or this is more of a tactile learner, or this is a more auditory learner, or visual learner. And yet we're still in that 80% model of 80% of the population learns auditorily with some visual thrown in. And we're still missing a huge chunk of our population. And those are not necessarily the students that qualify for special education. That's just students in general. And so that brings me to the co-teaching environment.
Yeah. Okay.
Talk about what that is and how, you know, you got involved in that and what it looked like.
Sure. Thanks. Well, co-teaching, when I was hired as a principal in the Cary, Illinois School District, that's C-A-I-Y, Cary, Illinois School District in 1989, I was hired as a principal there for an elementary school. And the district was just then that year initiating what they called the co-teaching model. And the emphasis at that time was to, they had a special ed model in place, which was mostly a pullout program, where the resource, the people that were trained in special ed back, had special ed backgrounds, which by this time, you know, different than the mid-1970s, now looking at 15 years later, our school, as most schools did then, had teachers who had certificates, degrees, coursework in special ed, which that we didn't have in the mid-70s. So the model at the time was to have the kids who were identified as special needs for whatever reason were usually pulled out, and that by they might have been pulled out into a resource room, they might have been pulled out, they were pulled out into their speech pathology or speech training, they were pulled out into if they had access to physical or occupational therapy on their IEPs, they were pulled out for that. So what, and these decisions had been made before I got to the district, but they had already, the woman in charge at the time, Cindy Morimoto of the special ed, said, we've got to figure out a way to break down the stigma of the kids who are being pulled out, of the kids that are leaving their classroom. Not only because there's a stigma, but because every time they leave, they're missing something that they could benefit from as well. If, yes. And sometimes they're missing from the camaraderie or their classmates. And so they instituted a model with the help of a consultant named Marilyn Friend. She spells it just like the word friend, F-R-E-N-D. And she, Marilyn, is her website still available if you Google it. And she still continues to work and do work in the field of co-teaching. So the idea then was that we wanted to take in our school, which had about 500 kids at the time, we had two self-contained teachers and one person that would, I guess they're all self-contained, right? But they were self-contained teachers at the time. So what do you do to get them working more closely with the classroom teacher? Other than sitting down at a table periodically for an IEP meeting or keeping up with data, even before the years of computer collection of data, but how do you enrich these experiences? And so the co-teaching model was one, instead of the child going out of the classroom to a room, the resource teacher, the special ed teacher, would go into the room where the child was. There you go. And so that, there's Marilyn Friend's website there. And so that was part of that whole model. And this would be a group of teachers, I believe, working together, this picture. But the idea that we used in our district, the school I was at in our district, was that we didn't change the hours that were available but instead of a child was assigned to a particular special ed teacher, but that special ed teacher worked with the classroom teacher. So what we did too in the teaching model was not every classroom, let's say we had three fourth grade classrooms, not every fourth grade classroom had students with IEPs. The way we did it at the beginning was one teacher, maybe two, would agree to say, I'll have the kids on my roster who have IEPs. That way that special ed teacher could develop a relationship with those one or two teachers at fourth grade. Then we built time into the schedule for them to meet together to talk about the plans that they had for each child. And then the resource teacher would go into the classroom to teach a lesson, co-teach a lesson with the classroom teacher. So if they were teaching a lesson on fractions, let's say, then they would do that together. And they would plan a lesson that both of them were teaching. So the kids got to see two teachers working together, which I think in itself is a powerful model, to see the kids, see those adults work in a way that's together. And then as students maybe would break for independent work, that the two teachers would float the room to help individuals, just like we would in any normal situation. Or the resource teacher might take a group of the students that are on her IEP or his IEP roster and take them along with a couple other kids and put them together at a table or a setting or a floor area to go over a particular part of the lesson. So there was always this flow in the room with this co-teaching model. Part of what we did in those first, it was exciting for me to be part of the first year of this because socially, professionally, socially, part of what we had to work through and work with was teachers' acceptance or resistance to doing this model. Some teachers didn't want another adult in their room. Right. So I think part of what we followed was, well, if you're not comfortable doing this, we'll certainly you'll have a classroom of students, but we'll do it more the way that you're used to or accustomed. Some teachers weren't ready for that kind of change. And there had to be a lot of respect for that and a lot of working around personalities and what we call the intersectionality of teachers that I mentioned earlier. And so part of my role became to work with the special ed coordinator, Cindy, to plan a series of in-services and trainings for the staff over a period of 2 years. So she and I would go to other trainings to train ourselves to how to co-teach. And it was just a great, wonderful way for me to be the principal in this district, to not only get the opportunity to have a building that was assigned to me, but also to work with others in the district and become this trainer, I'm looking for the right word, but to be the resource person to help people learn how to co-teach. And there was such energy in those trainings and such fun and enjoyment and eagerness for people to do it. And I was such a pleasure for me to be a part of these teams as they developed over the years. And I've been out of that district since I retired there in 2007, still communicate with them. But that model in different forms is still there. And I think that model is in a lot of schools now, whether they call it co-teaching or whether they call it integration or whatever name they give it. I like to think that the whole concept of two or three adults working together in the presence of students who they expect to be working together is very much a play on our education. It's certainly, we've gotten away from the teacher at the head of the class lecturing to a group of 15, 20, 25, 30 students at a particular grade level or a mixed age grade level grouping. It's much more of a team approach. And so when I think about collaborative teaching, certainly the word team comes into there.
Take a breath, take a drink.
I'm the guest here, Kevin. I'm not the host. So.
No, but this is your opportunity to share your story. I had my episode, number six of all these episodes. So it's all good. But when I think about what you just described, that first you had the teachers who had the buy-in from the beginning. And then you trained the other teachers so that hopefully you had buy-in from everybody. Mm-hmm. What I see now so often, and in my teaching career saw this as well, is that one teacher, and more often than not, it was the special ed teacher, was treated more as an aide, where they just walked around the classroom and monitored kind of everybody and helped everybody, but never had the opportunity to actually teach and show that collaboration.
We
need to get, I don't know how to fix that. Like, what was it besides the training that you did that got the rest of your teachers ready and prepared and felt comfortable being co-teachers?
There's about seven or eight questions here. one of the things I think we learned, is that you have, with working with adults, and certainly that's a whole nother kind of teaching than working with kids, but adult learning and how adults learn and how adults acclimate or change. That's a whole nother layer of becoming a school or a district which employs a co-teaching model. And what we did through Maryland's consult, and this we learned as we went along, but certainly with Maryland and other experts that were there helping us, was to let the staff grow at their own, I don't want to say, I guess, rates. Everybody has their own way to approach this. So it was never forced. We didn't say, you have to be a co-teacher. You have to be, that was the impression. We never wanted to give that impression to anybody. We wanted people that were willing to do this. And fortunately, in the school I was at, we found people. We were, at that point, we were divided on a single grade level configuration. We changed over the years to some options for multi-age and things. But at that point, when we started, we were doing things at particular grade levels. And fortunately, we had people at every team that were willing to do it. And there was probably, if I look back, there was some cajoling at the time because we couldn't not do it because this was the emphasis of the district. So we couldn't not do it. So in some cases, we might have to find the teacher who was most willing and without really twisting their arms or anything. So, but I guess that gets back into the whole development of teachers and the whole importance of respecting that and respecting how teachers themselves grow and learn and adapt. So that whole idea, back to what you're talking about, was something we certainly had to work through, not because the people that were assigned as special ed teachers, they wanted and deserved the respect that they too were certified teachers on the same salary schedule, on the same level, for lack of a better word. And yet in some situations, they were put in positions that they had to almost, they felt they had to earn the trust or the confidence or to have the other teachers let them teach, let them be equal. There we go, equal.
Yes.
In this. And so I think that was part of what we just kept struggling. I use the word struggle because depending on the collaboration, depending on who we were talking to and working with, it had different stages of development. And that was part, but then again, that was the exciting part, because to work with a team of two teachers, one special ed, one regular ed, and how they develop collaborative skills. The more they met, the more they learned each other's routines and strengths, the way they were able to just work themselves into a team that the kids could see. So, but I think back to your initial point, that was something we had to work on as we changed the culture. We had to, and I think even if you look back at a pullout model, I think sometimes teachers in a regular ed setting might have seen that pullout model as that special ed teacher was like an aide. I mean, that's a sort of a provincial thinking, but I don't remember having that much experience with that in the building I was in. People were treated each other pretty equal, very equally, and with a lot of respect. So even that being said, that was part of the thing we worked into our trainings, that when a special ed person comes into your room, they are not your aide. They are not to just sit in the back and pull people to a table. They are not just to come in and observe you and then help a kid here or there. We wanted both of them up front doing things together. And that jumps into when we were able to be part of an article on Instructor Magazine and got the cover that year, that month, of teachers working together and telling their story about how they had to work through that and how these two professional teachers with many years of experience came together to put lessons together and to do it together. And I think that was really a very gratifying time to not only get that recognition from a national publication, but to know that it's possible, to know that it works, to know that it's very viable, not only for the kids, but for the teachers as well. So.
Yeah. And what you said, about, you know, that when that special ed person comes in, they're not just your assistant, they're mm-hmm. an equal. Mm-hmm. And making sure, I think in a lot of districts, part of the problem is that the administration doesn't see special ed teachers as equal. Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. I sometimes think that our specials teachers are not looked at as equal either. I think we have a tier of our general ed teachers, and then there's a tier below that are the specials teachers, be that PE, computers, special ed, music, you know, whatever elective courses. And I don't know where that comes from, and I don't know how to address it, but mm-hmm. it does need to be remedied. And because I feel it will go a very long way, kind of wrapping this back around to that inclusion. Because yeah. if the teachers accept the other teachers in the building as an equal, and they see that happening, and then they also see both groups of teachers accepting all the students, no matter what ability level, no matter what socioeconomic status, no matter what home life, that is inclusion right there. And yes. we just, so many districts and then some educators within some of the best districts that I have heard have this very awful perspective of other teachers if a student doesn't fit that perfect mold of coming in, sitting, being very attentive, learning exactly the way the teacher teaches, there's this disconnect. And I really think we need to figure out how to make that connection. And then we can get some of that truer inclusion happening.
True. So true. So true. And I think, like to think there's more schools doing it than are not. And it's been my experience yes. In the last 10 years of my career, from 2010 to 2020, working here in Broward Schools, which is a different district than I had in Illinois, where I was sharing my prior experiences. And in the classrooms I was able to get into, I wasn't a principal. I didn't have any administrative responsibilities. So, but yeah, I could do a lot of observing and just participating. And we had different models we used to help kids and teachers be more inclusive, to help teachers monitor how they handled students from one of the behavior programs I worked with at that time was just to help teachers be aware of how they were distributing their discipline, how they were, their sense of fairness, their sense of, and we would accumulate the data to show them, you know, this is things that I thought maybe even working with more experienced teachers, and if I would get help, I would incur their trust and say, hey, try it this way, or could you do this? And I wasn't the principal. So that was, I'd been principal for over 20 years in the other district. Now I was coming in more as a peer or a consult or we called ourselves instructional facilitators at that time. So just the idea that they looked at me more as a peer and is to say, but they were eager for suggestions. Right. So that whole idea of inclusion and how do we include kids? How do we accommodate their abilities? I won't say disabilities. How do we accommodate their abilities in a setting where there's many, many abilities? And how do you make that work? I don't think that quest to do that is ever going to go away until we have a time where there's one teacher and one student tutoring, essentially, when, as long as we have more than one student in our classroom,
right,
this is something that a teacher is going to be questing to do all the time, and how to best provide for the students that are in their charge. So I think maybe sometimes you and I, our discussion today, we're talking about, oh, this isn't happening. It isn't happening. I think it is happening, but we're thinking it isn't, is because the challenges are never going to go away. The differences in kids are always going to be there. The differences in teachers are always going to be there. So it's, as I say that, I think I'm in one part of my brain, I'm representing, the one size fits all. there's still that framework in my head of one size fits all, but that's not true. It's never been true. It wasn't true when I was in first grade in 1956. It wasn't true, you know? So,
and that's a very good point, and one that I probably needed to be reminded of, that just like every student is not the same and doesn't learn the same and doesn't have the same capacity, every teacher doesn't go into teaching thinking, I'm going into teaching and I will teach any student who walks into my classroom. Many teachers go into teaching thinking, I think it's not even something that they're aware that they're thinking of. I've just got this perfect student in my head, and I've got this vision of my classroom and what the students look like and the great knowledge that I will impart. And then they get into their classroom and the reality happens. And many students are not like the students that they thought they were going to have in their classroom. And I don't know how we address that, because I think it is an individual situation, an individual issue, problem. I don't know what the right word there is, but individual thinking pattern maybe is the right way to say it. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of why I do this, because I feel that if we can give lots of exposure to people's abilities and people's potential and the possibilities of how education can look, that some of that will change for individuals. And then, you know, it will get better in the classrooms. And unfortunately, most of the situations where I am coming in as an IEP coach, it's not a perfect and happy situation. And so most of my experiences are more on the negative side of things. But I agree with you that there are hopefully many more places and many more schools and teachers doing it the better way than not.
Yeah. And I want to, at the end of what you're just saying, the word vigilance came into my head, because I think if a principal, when a principal, let's start with the superintendent, when a principal, when a superintendent is vigilant in this regard, it speaks a message to the principals, which then speaks a message to the teachers, which then speaks a message to the parents and the students. I'm using the word vigilance in a way that tying the word inclusive together, because I think this is something that we can never communicate enough about. And always to help people. A few images are coming to mind. You know, whether it's helping that parent at their child's birthday party, having an understanding of all the different personalities that are there, which I think comes natural to parents, I think, came natural, I would think. But to have that birthday party atmosphere, knowing that each of those students is going to be different. Well, that's the same kind of differences they have in their classroom. And when that classroom is part of a team of four or five other classrooms and teachers, each one is going to have their own collective personalities. And I guess that gets further represented by principals. I mean, it's when I got into my last 10 years of career, working more as a consult for two schools and principals, some of the same things I learned as a teacher about how to respect the differences in students, and then the same things I learned as a principal to say respect trust, engender the different interest capabilities, abilities of teachers. I did the same thing with principals. It was the same. It was the same, not the same. But there's still that list of variables, that list of ways to approach things, the ways some principals were willing to buy into stuff and wanted to, others were not. And how I had to reinvigorate myself each time to figure, okay, how am I going to work with this principal that's different than that one? And how can I have the strengths of this principle get conveyed to the strengths that I'd like to have brought out in the other one? So it's a chessboard comes to mind. I mean,
it's a good example.
This moving, and I don't play chess, but I know a little bit about the game, but just moving things around and never counting on any one position as being permanent. There's always a next move. There's always a strategy. Boy, we're getting into a lot of different things here.
Well, and that's what happens, because when you get two people who are in education and talking, there's so many parts of education that can be discussed. As you said, it's all always growing. And in always growing, you always find the things that you're trying to make better. Mm-hmm. And that tends to be, for whatever reason, the area that we tend to focus on are the things that could be better, instead of saying, hey, you know, we have co-teaching groups out there. We have co-teaching classrooms out there, and they are doing phenomenal. And so we need, you know, more focus on those co-teaching and inclusive environments, and more spotlights on those to say, look, this is part of why this group of people is so much happier. They're more productive. They're more successful. And they're even, I mean, I'm not a test score person, but that they're, you know, that everyone feels as though they're part of the school.
Yes, definitely.
And look to those types of environments.
Hey, you had mentioned earlier about, when we have the different categories of teachers at a building, and you use the word specials, which is pretty common, whether it's your art, music, PE, computer teachers, music, did I say music already? But I want to bring up a story just about this, whether I call it part of the co-teaching or the collaborative model. But as we... as teachers got more used to working with one another, and it was less a teacher dropping her or his students off at PE, or dropping them off at music, or dropping them off at art, and then leaving. There, sometimes we get the teachers staying there for a little bit, or the communication between those teachers. Hey, did you notice that was so-and-so? Or so that dialogue was informal all the time, but then it became more formal, where some of the specials teachers were invited and welcomed at the IEP meetings so they could give their input. And then we had one of our students was in a wheelchair. I think it was CP type situation, and he was in our building and from kindergarten on. And the PE teacher, since he was in a wheelchair, he did that when he came to class, and she would do things with him that would tailor the lesson to him. But one magical thing she did was figured out a way to get more wheelchairs into the gym. When the class came in, she might have three or four wheelchairs available. And she would say to this class of kids, okay, who wants to be in a wheelchair with Eddie? Who wants to be in a wheelchair? And so then they took however she set it up, that either it's kids who wanted to be. I don't think she ever had a problem with kids getting into the wheelchair. But every time that particular classroom, twice a week, went to PE, there was not just Eddie being in a wheelchair being adapted to or for, there were students who were also with him in their wheelchairs. So the idea that they got the experience a little bit of what it was like to be him, to what's it like to maneuver yourself, not only in the gym, but in the classroom. So to have a better have an understanding of his situation, to understand, and even knowing that Eddie was very capable of participating verbally in lessons and being part of a group that doing book research or whatever it was they were doing, they knew then what he brought to the table, you know, what he wheeled to the table,
right?
Because they were allowed, they were given the opportunity by their PE teacher, Chris, to have this experience. And I just thought, and there were parents that would compliment that situation, and because their kids would go home and say, I got to have the wheelchair today. What do you mean you got to have the wheelchair? And then understanding a little bit more about the student in their child's classroom who spent that part of his life and probably still does in a wheelchair. So this was 30 years ago. But I just think when you talk about co-teaching or the collaborative model or teachers working together, students working together, principals working together, there's so much at play here. And when you tie it back to your work with IEPs, when you're working on an individual education plan, it's important to have as many voices in there as possible. So on the individual, I'm sure you do this in your work, how is the art teacher going to respond to this particular student and their needs? Or the PE teacher, the music teacher, how are they going to adapt this? And I think those are discussions that went on in our co-teaching model, our collaborative teaching model, our inclusive teaching model, learning model, that really were at play often and helped to contribute to the culture of the school. I relish those years.
It sounds like a wonderful time. And I'm sure that all of your students benefited tremendously during that time. And hopefully those are people that today are including others in the workplace and in family situations and in their recreational times that maybe they wouldn't have done had they not had that experience.
Yeah, I love the way you say that. You know, so much of what we do in teaching and education, we have our year or more in the multi-age setting. Oftentimes you get more than 1 year, but for the looping settings, you get more than 1 year when the teacher has the opportunity to keep the kids for more than 1 year. But even when we let go of those kids, there's a little bit of grief when you let go of kids.
Yep.
But you wonder what sticks. You wonder what they take with them. They wonder, like what you said earlier in your comments, how does what we did carry with these people as they have a family when they get into their careers, whether it's teaching or business or whatever.
Right.
What did they? And I guess that goes back to the beginning of my conversation a little bit. You know, the things I learned being raised in a funeral home. I feel that presence in my career and in my discussion I'm having with you right now, but I got to believe and I got to hope and I believe that what we engendered and the culture we provided for kids has an impact on the way they approach their life. And I think that's all one of the things we can hope for as teachers, that we want our effects to be lasting. And we want kids to remember our name, and we want kids
in a good way, not in a bad way.
Sometimes even that's okay too, I guess. But more so, you want your kids, your former students, to remember you. And when I get a little note from somebody on, the magic world of the internet, when somebody connects and says, "I remember when you did this in 1982," or whatever the year picks out, and I think, wow. That little 5 minutes made an impact on them. And when I get a story like that, I think, well, if they're telling me that story, I've got to believe that there's other stories too. And I know that for my own case, when I look back on what teachers did for me, and if they're still alive, I make an effort to try to find them to tell them, here's what I thought about this. And I hope there's, whether we're talking about IEPs or individual action, I mean, every kid has an IEP, whether it's formalized or not. What we do in a successful classroom is we have an IEP for every kid. And it's not just because by their test scores or the data assessments that they're in a category to get one. Every kid has an IEP. So I think that when I think that way and thinking back to the individualization that each of us as teachers provide to our kids, I take a breath and I think that kid from 1978, what does he remember about me? What does he remember about our school? What does he remember, or she? Or they, using proper pronouns now. What do they remember about those experiences? What nuggets jump into their head, you know, when they're playing with their kids or their grandkids, or when they're involved in a tough meeting with their boss? What comes into their mind about second grade? So,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I just believe that's all there.
I hope so. The time has flown, and it is time for us to wrap this up today. So
okay.
Before we go, I just want to give you opportunity, if there you have any last words that you wanted to share, that you have that opportunity to do so now.
Oh, wow. Yeah, thanks. Well, I appreciate this. And as we've remarked a couple times, you get two educators in the same spot, and I'm never at a loss for words with them. I'm in a fortunate position, especially with where I was principal for 18 years at Maplewood School in Cary. Even though I retired there in 2007, and I think almost everybody that was there then in 2007 with in our school, or there's just a few left that haven't retired in 17 years. But we still have a group that gets together. We still have a bond whether it's through a Zoom meeting or when I'm back in town at that location, we get together. We did a couple of months ago. We just savor these opportunities. And I think I'm pretty sure this happens in most careers, most professions, that you build lasting friendships and relationships that outlive the time you spent together in a building or a district. And I think when we talk about, we've been talking about IEPs. The IEP meetings I sat at both as a teacher, as a principal, and as a parent, because I had that opportunity too with my kids to sit at IEP tables with them or for them. Is this built on relationships? And I thank you so much for the opportunity to 4 years out of my own retirement from education. But those 50 years that I had certainly had been treasured. And I just I value what you're doing to keep discussions going. And as I've listened to some of your podcasts the last couple of weeks into this, the vast topics that you talk about. And it's just not about it's about individuality. It's about what people do for their kids, whether it's as a parent, as a teacher, as a technician. I just think it's beautiful the stories you're able, and just your analogy of that, as I look at your logo up there, that whole, aren't we all caterpillars? And aren't
yes.
we all caterpillars? And I think sometimes I think the older I get, that I get I think I go back into a caterpillar through different parts of my life because I learn new things and I have to regenerate now with this book and marketing the book and telling the stories. And I'm getting into a whole idea of where grief comes into our life. I think that's just part of another cocoon process I'm going through. So yeah. I think so.
So
much of what we teach our kids in education is we're all butterflies, but we're all caterpillars too. And we get to repeat the very hungry caterpillar. We go back to Kitty Litt.
Yeah.
We go back to that and just that we're always, I feel like I'm always emerging and becoming a butterfly. And then I lay an egg or two and I recreate and I go back and go back. So I think it's a nice theme that you have and everything. So I'm very energized this time that we've been had talking, which is way over an hour, I think. But I appreciate the time, and I hope that what we've been talking about will generate interest among other people as well.
I do too. Thank you again so much. And yeah, this was Shelley Keno with Kevin O'Connor, and we were talking about inclusion and co-teaching and just students and life in general. And I hope you've enjoyed your time listening or watching, depending on how you are absorbing this information. And be sure to like and subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. And I will see you next time so that we can all make the world better for everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Shelley. Thank you.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelley Keno, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelley Keno, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelley Keno is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shelleykeno.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shelleykeno.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.